One year after he became Attorney General is a great time for Attorney General Brad Schimmel to share with us his vision for 2016 and talk about some other issues. General, welcome back to Wisconsin Eye.
Thank you, Steve. I always enjoy talking with you.
I would, before we get to your 2016 goals, I've got some follow-up questions regarding President Obama's executive orders on criminal background checks.
Okay.
First question, are you opposed to what President Obama wants to do or the methodology, the process, executive orders, the way he wants to do it?
Well, much of what he proposed isn't really going to change anything.
Really?
There were things that are happening already. There are some things that he's proposed that it's the methodology, like the proposal about such a broad ban. And we have to wait until the rule is released. Right now, it's just a speech.
Yep.
So as a lawyer, I'll wait till the rules come out and we'll see what it looks like. But in his speech, he intimated that we would have a wide net cast over a number of people that get Social Security disability payments, and that they'll automatically be ineligible to make a gun purchase. I think he's trying to catch people who are incompetent.
Okay.
Who have mental health issues, yes.
Okay.
And you, constitutionally, if we're going to take away people's gun rights, we have to have something that links them to dangerousness. You know, so traditionally, felony convictions, we've been able to establish that's a link to dangerousness. And that satisfies the Second Amendment. We have to be very careful about who we take those rights away from. That's the one place where, as I look at it from, you know, a legal perspective, we may have a challenge. That's so far where we've identified that.
What about, I want to ask you about some of the specific other changes that the president has announced he hopes to make. Number one, he wants existing law clarified so that hobbyists are considered to be in the business of selling guns if they have an online gun store, pass out business cards, or frequently sell guns in original packaging. Is this a reasonable or a not reasonable change, General?
You know, he hasn't put much specificity on it. There's not a number at this point. Again, there may be a rule that follows the speech that gives us more specificity so we know whether to criticize this or not. But right now, it wouldn't be reasonable for him to put a restriction that really doesn't give people any idea whether they're breaking the law or not. And right now, what he talked about in his speech just isn't definite enough. I suspect we're going to see some follow-up with some actual specific rules.
Do you think this is a problem?
It's one area. You know, many have talked about the president's speech and criticized that he's not focusing on the real source of the problem, and I agree with them. These are restrictions that are going to hamper the activities of law-abiding citizens without really having any impact on what the bad guys do. You know, there's the old bumper sticker that the NRA had. I remember this, I think, when I was a kid, that said, if you outlaw guns, only outlaws will have guns. There's a lot of truth to that. You can make things more difficult for the law-abiding, but the people who aren't inclined to abide by the law, they don't care about these rules. You know, if a person's planning to rob a liquor store, they don't care whether they had a concealed carry permit to carry that gun tucked in their waistband. We've got a lot of laws we can enforce better. And if we can focus on that, I think we can make a difference. You know, for instance, that's what we're doing in Milwaukee with the partnership we have with DOJ, the Milwaukee DA's office, the Milwaukee Police Department, the Mayor's Office, Department of Corrections. All of that is focused on identifying the trigger pullers, identifying the people who don't care what our rules are, and finding ways to hold them accountable. And I think some of the things we're doing, like having designated prosecutors, a team of six of them, that do nothing but gun violence cases, and then designated investigators, there's about 20 of them, and they all know each other. Part of the big problem in Milwaukee is it's so big, there's not accountability often. By having these people work together day after day, they're accountable to each other, they answer to each other, and I think they'll make a real difference. And if we can pull, we're not talking about thousands of people, we're talking about a couple hundred trigger pullers. If we can get those people out off the streets and locked up where they should be, and there's not going to be anybody, this isn't going to offend anybody who is worried about that we lock up too many people. These are people that there's going to be general agreement. These people are dangerous to the community. They're making it harder for normal citizens to go to school, to go to work, to take care of their yard, to enjoy their lives. We take these people out, we can make a big difference.
Well, that was one of my follow-up questions. Is this new unit, this new level of cooperation at all levels, is it now up and running? And if it's not up and running, how soon will it be?
It is up and running.
It is. You already seeing results, do you think?
It's too early to start claiming victories because we don't have convictions yet. But we do have that team working together. They know each other. They've picked up a number of old cases that were pending already and are going to see those through to completion. But now as new gun incidents are coming in, they're working together. This has got all aspects of the Milwaukee Police Department are pieces of this, from the Fusion Center that's developing information on that's linking guns that are used in crimes to particular individuals all the way to the prosecution. And our goal really is to see the Milwaukee courts, the gun courts specifically, start to feel so much pressure that they open up a second gun court again like they had years ago. We want to give them that kind of workload.
Well, you and I know that 2015 was a very sad year for homicides, especially by gun in Milwaukee.
Right.
Do you think this effort will lead to fewer gun homicides in Milwaukee in 2016, General?
I do. I think this group has a chance to make a difference quickly. These individuals talk. There's the word on the street. They know when law enforcement's coming after them. They know, and as we pick off some of their colleagues, more and more of them are going to recognize they have to change the way they're doing business. Right now, they're doing things pretty boldly because right now, in recent years, the conviction rate for homicides, and so you call it a clearance rate sometimes, that has dropped to nearly 50%. It had, at one point, Milwaukee had the best or one of the best in the nation. They were at 92% clearance rate for homicides. Now they're pushing down to 50. Imagine this, as you commit a homicide in Milwaukee, you have a 50-50 chance of getting away with it. We have to change that.
Is part of that because of the Journal Sentinel has been reporting on witness intimidation efforts?
Absolutely. Absolutely, that is a piece of it.
A piece of it or the biggest piece of it, General?
I don't know that it's the biggest piece.
Okay.
It's a piece of it. You know, one of the other moving parts of this initiative involves the Department of Corrections, and they've authorized overtime for agents to go out on weekends and nights when you're more likely to find a person violating the conditions of their supervision. They're going to go out with Milwaukee Police to do house checks, to do bar checks, to make sure that if you're under supervision at Department of Corrections, you're where you're supposed to be. Many, I don't remember the number, but Chief Flynn has statistics on it. It's more than well over half of the individuals that are committing these gun crimes are people who are already on some kind of supervision. We've got a great opportunity to start taking care of that problem right there.
The President has also said, and yes, it's important to note that you don't have the actual language yet. In terms of the executive
right.
orders. But another goal would be a change to stop people from buying machine guns and sawed-off shotguns through corporate entities and trusts without background checks. I wasn't aware that this was a huge issue. Is it a big issue, General?
This is one of those things that doesn't make a difference in the end. A sawed-off shotgun is already illegal in Wisconsin. We catch you possessing that, you're committing a crime. Machine guns, you already cannot own those unless you have a Class 3 federal issued firearms license. Those are tough to get. Very few people have them, and the background check for that is absolutely enormous. Anybody else who doesn't have that proper permit and has a machine gun, you're violating Wisconsin law and federal law, and we're going to prosecute you for that.
Now, let's go back to a line in your last statement after the governor asked you to take a look at suing over the executive orders. You said, we must as a state take steps to more effectively enforce our existing gun laws. Is this a reference to the new initiative in Milwaukee?
It is in part, yes.
Okay, and what other laws must we do a better job of enforcing?
Well, you know, as Chief Flynn would say, when we catch people who have a gun that shouldn't have it, they should expect to be prosecuted and convicted for that. But we've got to close those investigations better. And with the prosecutors and the law enforcement officers having direct accountability to each other, if the DA, if the prosecutor thinks that there needs to be a different investigation or more investigation, they know who to go to. If the law enforcement officer thinks, hey, you're not taking this case seriously enough, they know where to turn to. That communication is going to make a big difference. That team can do it. And this isn't the first time that we've done this. Years ago, Milwaukee County had a serious challenge with this, and they did a similar thing. The only difference was then the state wasn't involved. We're one more piece in the arsenal this time.
Having been in office a year, is there any additional change in state gun laws that you now think should be made based on your experience?
I don't think that's where our problems are.
Okay.
You know, there's a recent proposal about changing rules relating to possession of a gun on school grounds. And I know the mayor of Milwaukee has objected to that greatly. I think his objections are misplaced. You know, a large part of this is individuals who legally possess a gun, they have a concealed carry permit, and if they're going to drop their child off at school, and they normally carry, they can't pull into the school turnaround where you drop your kids off, or you can't park in the parking lot and leave your gun locked in the car. Those aren't the guns we're afraid of at a school.
But Mayor Barrett told reporters he's also afraid about parents who legally have concealed weapons coming into the classroom, teachers having concealed weapons in the classrooms. So mm-hmm. He says it's a bigger danger than someone who has a permit just dropping off their kid.
See, I think, again, the fear of people who have completed proper background checks, legally own their gun, have a concealed carry permit, those aren't the people we need to be afraid of. When we hear about school shootings, that's not the people we're worried about. It's people with mental illness issues. It's people who have a violent history and didn't purchase the gun. They got it from someone else. Those people, you can put all the signs on the front door of the school that say no weapons allowed. That's not stopping them. We have similar problems with restraining orders, that a piece of paper isn't stopping a person from going after a victim. We need to have a bigger safety plan, and that's something we work with domestic violence victims now. We're increasing those efforts. It's one of the things in 2015 I'm proud of, is that our team at DOJ has been doing regional trainings throughout the state that have gotten great reviews, and a big part of that is domestic violence training to help law enforcement and prosecutors and victim advocates understand better how we can make sure victims have a safety plan. But just like that piece of paper, a restraining order isn't stopping a person that's bent on committing a violent act, all signs and the prohibitions in the world are not going to stop a person who is bent on going into a school to commit violence. But what if that person has a concern that a law-abiding citizen or a member of the staff at that school is armed? Does that make them think twice? I don't know, because with mental illness and people that are, you know, that aren't thinking rationally, they may not be weighing that anyway.
So you support the Senator Lozick bill that would allow those with valid concealed weapon permits to be able to carry on school grounds?
I do. And I support the bill also has provisions for the school to make determinations as to what's permitted within the school itself, and I support that local control. Let that school make their own decisions.
You've had a year to think about this. What do you think can prevent future San Bernardinos, future Planned Parenthoods in Colorado, these tragic incidents as a nation?
Well, unfortunately, a big part of solving this problem is going to be addressing mental illness issues.
Okay.
And That is going to be very costly, and that is a very dangerous balance to try to strike, because we have to try to predict people who are going to be dangerous who may not have exhibited overt signs of that. And maybe they've, you know, are we going to take away rights from people who just talk crazy or make us uncomfortable? We can't do that. So to some degree, we can't prevent all those things. And when you talk about San Bernardino, those are people that are acting as terrorists. I'm not sure that they cared whether they lived or died after that incident happened. they seem to have taken steps to escape. When you look at Paris, those individuals were prepared to die in the act. It's very difficult to stop them. Although I can tell you, as you know, part of Department of Justice, I have the Wisconsin Strategic Information Center, or our state fusion center, is part of my responsibility. I oversee that, and we do have briefings. And our security agencies are finding out an awful lot of information. There are still bad things that are being prevented. They do have information in some of the attacks that they don't know enough to single in on what's going to happen and prevent it, but it's getting better all the time, and we need to keep working forward with that.
Some local police departments, as you're well aware, are holding seminars, public meetings, to stress run, hide, fight.
Yes.
Do more and more local police law enforcement agencies have to hold those meetings? Have we come to that point?
You know, we actually have gotten permission from, I think it's the Houston Police Department that developed that video, and we've gotten permission from them to use it. A trade association in Wisconsin wants to use it to educate members of their association, their businesses. It's a decision for businesses to make. You know, you want to do this for your employees. I certainly encourage businesses and public institutions like schools. It's worth giving your staff an idea of what you might want to do. I mean, every situation is going to be different. See, there's no magic, here's your answer, and that's why it's run, hide, fight. Why it starts with, if you can escape safely, do that. Mm-hmm. If you can't, get to cover. And if cover's not going to do it for you, then fight back. Don't just wait to be murdered. I think that education, more people should hear it. It's not a matter of we should have people running in the streets afraid for their lives every day, because these are still relatively isolated incidents. But you don't want to not be prepared.
Well, thanks for your patience. Now let's talk about your goals for 2016.
Okay.
You recently testified on behalf of, how do you say it? Alicia's Law?
Oh, Alicia's Law.
Alicia's Law. Thanks for the correction. Why is that so important, sir?
Well, we're seeing challenges with the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. Two issues that this bill would address. One, or this law would address if it gets passed, and one is funding. We have seen the number of referrals or tips coming from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children go up from, I think it was 266 in 2005. In 2015, it was 1,300. And the resources we have to combat that have remained relatively stable. They're certainly far from keeping pace with it. I recognize that the state does not have the money to just keep writing me checks for every public safety initiative that I want to take on, but this one's important. Every day that goes by that we aren't as law enforcement exploiting the information we can obtain on the internet to track these people is a day that a child might be living in torture and rape and abuse, which is the story that Alicia tells as she testifies in our legislature and in legislatures across America. Every day that we don't take advantage of those opportunities is a day that a child suffers. So we need to be able to act quickly, and part of that is having the resources. Another part of it is get rid of the bureaucratic steps, and one of them is getting a look at what I characterize as the phone book. Just like the phone company has a list of all the numbers and to whom they're assigned, internet service providers have a list of what's called an internet protocol address, the IP address, and the person to whom that particular internet connection is assigned. What we want to do is make it a quicker process to get a look at that phone book. Once we get a look at that phone book, you know, we'll get in Madison, we'll receive from NCMEC the cyber tip. Mm-hmm. We then need to figure out which law enforcement agency around the state should be the one that gets this case to do the investigation and see whether there's a basis to get a search warrant. The quicker we can do that, the quicker we can get a look at the phone book, the quicker law enforcement at the local level starts their investigation and gets that search warrant. A search warrant, and by the way, The administrative subpoena provisions in this law would not authorize law enforcement to seize any property. It would not authorize law enforcement to look at the content of anyone's communications or anyone's private things. All this does is let us see what the internet company already knows more quickly.
Opiate addiction is
my number one priority.
Your number one priority. Here's my question. Which of the four HOPE bills that passed the Assembly Tuesday would have the most effect, would do the most good, and why?
You know, I think ultimately from the legislative side, it's going to be the changes we make to the prescription drug monitoring program. Other states have done this and have found that many more doctors become registered into the PDMP so that they're checking it before they prescribe. And once they do, we've seen in those other states the amount of opioids prescribed drop, and or at least level off. In Wisconsin, it keeps climbing. We now issue four times as many prescriptions for opioids than we did just a little over a decade ago. And it should be no surprise then that we've also seen the number of deaths from overdoses quadruple. The things go hand in hand. There are responsible uses. I always want to be clear about this. I'm not a doctor. I have no business telling doctors or patients how to resolve pain issues. But when there are flags that are out there, that we should have the doctor taking a look.
Are you satisfied with the response of the medical community to engaging in this debate?
I'm thrilled with the response because the State Medical Society, the Milwaukee Medical Society, the Hospitals Association, the Dental Association, the Pharmacy Society, they all partnered with us nearly a year ago to begin crafting this message. What we announced back in September, the Dose of Reality campaign, was with the help of all those organizations helping us craft it, and now they are working hard to address their membership to change prescribing practices. So on the one hand, I'm working on getting citizens in our state aware of the danger and of the simple steps they need to take to keep their families safer. And on the other side, the medical community is working on their members to change prescribing practices. Hand in hand, those two things together, I think, can make a difference.
DOJ's representative on the Public Records Board voted this week to reverse the board's August decision dealing with whether you have to archive transitory online records.
Right.
Another records board member, not the DOJ, called that August change a modest tweak that was overblown in news stories. Here's my question, because you've made open government one of your top goals. Was that August change only a modest tweak or a threat to your goal of open government?
You know, I think the judgment is in the reaction that happened. And the Public Records Board did not recognize how big a concern that was going to be. And I'm pleased that they've made the decision to say, you know, why wait for potential litigation to get filed, and we have turmoil, and then we wait for a decision. Why not take the simple step? Can't undo or void what happened at the previous meeting. Have another hearing. Let people be heard. And I think we saw a successful result of doing that.
How do you feel about the principle, though? Should online transitory, whatever that means, emails be kept and preserved as part of the archive?
You know, I think the message for all in government is it's not where the communication takes place, be it the internet or on a tweet or email or whatever, or on a piece of paper that somebody hands. It's not where the communication takes place. It's the nature of the communication that determines whether it's a public record. So as technology is changing the way we communicate, we have to keep up in our public records laws. And that's really what instigated the Open Government Summit back in July.
Yes.
And what I'm trying to work with, I actually will be attending very soon another of the Freedom of Information Council meetings. I've been trying to get to as many of those as I can because I want to engage. I think there are sensible changes we can make that will, in the law, address these issues, or issues like body cameras for law enforcement. You know, right now, law enforcement has no guidance. So if they equip their officers with body cameras, When that officer goes into a private citizen's home to investigate a complaint,
civil dispute, domestic,
you name it, we certainly want to be able to monitor the behavior of that officer. The public has a right to that, but where do you draw the line between monitoring the officer's behavior and the privacy rights of the person in that home? We may get to a point where if an officer's got a body camera on, a citizen's going to say, listen, I'll talk to you outside, but you're not coming in my house. And that hurts us. That hurts because officers do often discover other background information when they're in that house in a voluntary interview.
But isn't it fair to say that your position has generally been, when in doubt, you should preserve the record?
Yes.
That's what I thought. Okay, just two more questions. You can't talk about the investigation at Lincoln Hills, but can you give us a time frame for when it might be over, sir?
You know, I wish I could put a time frame on it. This is a complex investigation.
How many agents? How many of DOJ employees are working on it?
Well, it depends on the snapshot in time. You know, back in December, we had a moment where we had about 50 of our staff, half of all of the Division of Criminal Investigation was up at the two schools.
How about today?
Taking a look at it. Today, it's more of a handful.
Okay.
And they're working at, there are great challenges here because the young men and young women who are in these institutions, they got there for a reason. They committed delinquent acts. Sometimes their delinquent acts were driven by a history of trauma in their own lives. Many have mental illness problems. Many come from substance abuse problems. It puts us in a position that we have to corroborate the things that they're reporting to us before we can go forward with a criminal case. And also, they do have some challenges as historians. Often they don't know. They can say, well, back when my arm got broken, a guard twisted it. That's a hypothetical. But they might not be able to tell us who that was. So we have to go back and find the records. So this is a time-consuming type of investigation. What I think the most important thing is as each allegation we've received that pointed us in the direction of any specific youth counselor at the institution, if we got information that pointed us to one, we shared that with DOC, and DOC would put that person on paid leave. Now, that person, that is a raw allegation at that point. We don't even have enough to consider a criminal charge yet, but we've erred on the side, and DOC has of removing the threat, the potential threat, from the institution. That's expensive, of course, because now they're going to have to replace that person and still pay someone, but it's the right thing to do till we get to the bottom of it.
Given the seriousness of some of the allegations, is the handful of DOJ people helping run Lincoln Hills, or is DOC still running Lincoln Hills?
We can't run a correctional institution. We don't know how, and we even if I put all of DOC up there, I don't think we'd have enough people. They have more than our 100 agents that run that. No, we can't run that, and we can't be in there all the time. You know, it's different than a standard investigation in a neighborhood somewhere where we can go conduct surveillance whenever we want. When we send somebody up to Lincoln Hills or Copper Lake to do an interview, they have to sign in and go through security screening and they're known to be there. It's part of what alarmed us later in the year when, in the course of the investigation, which had been proceeding, making progress, when we discovered later in the year that there had been some additional incidents that occurred now. We were investigating historical things, and now suddenly there was something more recent that concerned us because I don't think it was a secret to anyone that there was an investigation underway because DCI agents were signing in at the front door.
Right. Okay, my last question is kind of a light one. There's a Republican presidential debate tonight. Have you endorsed anybody?
No. And I don't
expect
to.
Are you going to before the April primary in Wisconsin?
I don't expect to, no.
You don't?
I've kind of made a call that I'm staying out of primaries and I'm staying out of judicial races and trying to be the state's lawyer. I a lot of people who normally vote Democrat tell me they voted for me. Even if they hadn't, I represent, as the state's lawyer, I have responsibilities to all of the people of this state, whether you vote Republican or Democrat or independent or whatever. So I'm going to try to, I am political personally, but I'm trying to keep the job not apolitical. And so as Attorney General, I'm going to stay away from those things.
Attorney General Brad Schimmel, thanks for the update very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks.